The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Lillian, thank you very much for the introduction. It's very nice to see you here. It's very nice to see your colleagues here. It's very nice to be at AU. It's not the first time I visited this law school, and it's very nice to be back. I'm going to talk maybe for about half an hour about what this book is about and why I wrote it and what it seeks to do, and then we can throw it open to discussion and to question. This is a book about America's engagement with the international community, and more specifically, America's engagement with global rules. It tells a story that begins in August 1941 and brings us right up to the second term of the administration of George W. Bush, and focuses on the question, does the United States remain committed to the system of global rules that it did more than any other country to put in place in the 1940s? And the answer to that question is, at this point, we don't know. There are some signs, and I'll end on a note of optimism, in a sense, that the Bush administration has begun to recognize that some of the very worst excesses in which it has been engaged in violation of international law have come at a terrible price, as a result of which its relations with many of its allies and its friends have been strained to a point at which they are virtually breaking. So that's the story that I want to tell. It begins on board a boat in August 1941, off the coast of Newfoundland, whilst the Second World War was waging, but shortly before the attacks on Pearl Harbor, when the United States joined in that global war. Churchill and Roosevelt met, and one of their objectives was to agree on a blueprint for how the world would be ordered after the Nazis had been vanquished. And the document they adopted, which I've included as the very first page in a facsimile version of the book, is known as the Atlantic Charter. And the Atlantic Charter is a one-page document which sets out 8 guiding principles for a new global order. And they are arranged under an overarching theme that the world will be reconstituted under a rules-based system, so that there will be a global rule of law approach to the reordering of international society. The 8 principles can be reduced down to 3 basic foundations, and they are the pillars of the modern international legal order. First, the prohibition on the use of force in a binding legal instrument. Second, the promotion of fundamental human rights and the protection of what the Charter refers to as the dignity of the human individual, and that is the modern law of self-determination and, of course, of human rights. And third, new systems to promote global economic liberalization. Reference is made in particular to the Charter, to free trade rules under a multilateral arrangement that, of course, led to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the World Trade Organization, but implicit in that also are the economic rules on investment protection and on intellectual property. That path-breaking document, which had a profound impact, there's a wonderful little passage that I refer to in Nelson Mandela's autobiography where he describes the Atlantic Charter being published in a newspaper in South Africa. He clips it and he walks around with it in his breast pocket, because for him, that document marked the end of colonialism and the end of apartheid, although he waited many decades, was of huge and profound importance. It was the basis for the legislative effort led by the United States, beginning in the mid-1940s, 1943, 1944, to create a new architecture of international institutions and rules. The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in the economic field, United Nations, the United Nations Charter in relation to the use of force and to a certain extent also human rights, Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the Nuremberg Charter and Statute of the Nuremberg Tribunal, the Tokyo Tribunal, the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War. All of these instruments were adopted in that period, and all of these instruments were adopted with overwhelming and strong support from the United States, which played a leadership role, recognizing that rules would promote and serve its interests. And this is not altruism at play. The United States plainly recognized that these global rules would serve its interests by promoting American values. You see that most directly, for example, in the writings of Eleanor Roosevelt in relation to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And for the next 4 or 5 decades, that system of global rules was one that perhaps didn't work always perfectly, but which nevertheless had a strong degree of support from the United States across the political spectrum, Republican and Democrat, although there's always been a tension towards an isolationist or an exceptionalist doctrine in the United States. It worked more or less pretty well. And I cite, for example, in the book, in the chapter on environmental protection, something that is little known, certainly outside the United States, that in a sense the founding father of the United Nations Environment Program and of the global environmental rules-based system was none other than President Nixon, a Republican, who played an absolutely central and important role in creating global environmental rules and who strongly supported global environmental rules. I know we have to pinch ourselves to remind ourselves that that could have happened, that the sort of Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2 would have been preceded, but there is no sort of inherent skepticism in a Republican to environmentalism or to global rules. And that's something that we've come to forget, which in a sense provides a hint of optimism because things may again yet change. The world was not necessarily a wonderful place in that period. We had conflicts, Vietnam, we had terrible mass atrocities in Rwanda, in the Balkans, and in other parts of the world. But it was always accepted that the rules, which had been set up in the 1940s and the 1950s, provided the framework within which to judge and respond to these events. Problems began to emerge with a small group who took office in the Reagan administration and who I think were profoundly affected by the efforts of Nicaragua to bring a case against the United States in the mid-1980s concerning support by the United States to the Contras. And that group, which served also in George Bush's first, the senior George Bush administration, really began to work actively to address the threat they saw as being posed by these global rules during the presidency of Mr. Clinton. And in 1997, they adopted a policy instrument known as the Project for a New American Century. And the heart of the Project for a New American Century is that the system of global rules fundamentally threatens American interests, and they intend to dismantle it. What they had in mind in particular was the instruments which were being then negotiated, such as the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, global warming. When President George W. Bush came into office in January 2001, he wasted no time at all in ratcheting up, if you like, what became a system-wide attack on the system of global rules. He unsigned both Kyoto and the Rome Statute, and he made it clear that there would be no further multilateral arms negotiations treaty on his watch. So even before September the 11th, it is plain that there was a systematic effort, if you like, to step back from the global rules-based system. And the first signs were there that the post-Second World War settlement, which America had led, would effectively be addressed in a negative way by this new Bush administration. Now, not all global rules were under attack. It is not right that the administration of George W. Bush has adopted the approach that all treaties are bad and all global rules are bad. Essentially, there has been a bifurcation and a distinction between what one might call good international law and bad international law. Good international law is the international law that promotes American interests, free trade rules, foreign investment rules, intellectual property rules. Those treaties, even John Bolton will accept, are binding. And then there's the bad international law, the international law which constrains the exercise of American power and constrains the exercise of American sovereignty, the rules that limit the use of force, the rules that protect fundamental human rights, and, as we've seen, the rules that prevent you from interrogating or torturing detainees in times of war and in times of peace. Along comes 9/11. And what I'm about to say is not very popular in the United States, and it's difficult to say, but I can assure you outside the United States resonates such as to put me entirely within mainstream opinion. 9/11 was used by the Bush administration explicitly to move forward the agenda of unmaking global rules. And a climate of fear was generated to essentially eliminate, in an intellectual sense, any opposition to the agenda. If you are not with us, you are against us. Operated as a remarkably powerful technique of essentially silencing the media and silencing many academics, including left-wing academics, in a vital period between September the 11th and the publication of the Abu Ghraib pictures in the summer of 2004. As part of the if you're not with us, you're against us movement, a small group within the White House, but in particular coalesced and organized under Vice President Dick Cheney's office, set in place a system for unmaking the rules. And I've put in the book plenty of quotations from individuals associated with this who explicitly and publicly say, we're going to use this moment to change the rules, and we're going to do it unilaterally. Of course, anyone who's done international law knows that rulemaking internationally is a consensual business, treaty making requires partners, and you can't unilaterally amend or terminate a treaty. You need to do so in a consensual way of engagement with your treaty partners. That didn't bother these individuals, many of whom were academics who had been parachuted in to positions of high decision-making office as legal advisors or consultants in the Department of Defense or in the Department of Justice. I'm thinking of people like John Yoo at Berkeley, Jack Goldsmith then of Chicago, now at Harvard Law School. And I'll come back to say a little bit more about their role in due course. What did they do? Well, the very first thing they did through their president was to declare a war on terror. That effort was wholly misconceived and will be shown to have been a mistake of historical proportions. It was done explicitly to engender the type of climate which would encourage people to rally around the president. But more prosaically, what it did was it articulated a decision to abandon the use of the criminal law and move into the language and rhetoric of warfare. But what these people appreciated but didn't fully wish to take into account was that the language of warfare comes accompanied with rules governing the conduct of warfare. And here they faced, in a sense, their first roadblock. Just before I describe what that roadblock is, let me say a little bit more about why the creation of a so-called war on terror was so wholly misconceived. By treating the individuals associated with 9/11 and beyond in Afghanistan and in other parts of the world as individuals involved in a war on terror, you are effectively characterizing them as warriors. They're not warriors, they're criminals. The IRA in Britain went through exactly the same process over a 25-year period of seeking to persuade the British government to characterize their activity as warrior-like activity. And the British government rightly decided against that, because the British government knew that when you characterize a group as warriors, you tend to elevate their status. And that's precisely what has happened. if you would want to design a response better placed to play into the hands of Al-Qaeda, who place a very real threat to us, you would have done precisely what George W. Bush did. You simply transform criminals into warriors. But you then come up face to face with a second problem. Because you are engaged in a war and not in the exercise or enforcement of international criminal law, you make it very much more difficult for friendly partners to participate in that activity. It's quite one thing to reach out to Arab countries and ask them to cooperate with you in the enforcement of criminal law, which they will do. It's quite another thing to ask them to participate with you in a war against another Arab group, which they won't do, for perfectly understandable and justifiable reasons. And it turns out that no one in the administration asked themselves those questions. What is the best way to prosecute our response to what is a heinous act in that period? There was a knee-jerk, ill-thought-through response which was intended to galvanize domestic public opinion and to silence opposition, and it worked brilliantly. Everyone fell, for the most part, with a few minor exceptions, into that trap. Having characterized the effort as a war, they then realized they would have to deal with the consequences of waging a war. The consequence of waging a war is that you bring people into detention. Difficulty with war, in this regard, is that there are rules on the conduct of warfare, and in particular, there are rules which limit your treatment of detainees, and in particular, your interrogation of detainees. Basically, you can't interrogate them. The Bush administration is then involved in a tremendous fight regarding the characterization of the individuals they begin to apprehend in Afghanistan, Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And they come face to face with a very real difficulty. Do the detainees they have apprehended in Afghanistan obtain protections under the Geneva Conventions? If so, they have a very real problem because they can't interrogate them and they have to treat them in a particular way. The Bush administration, therefore, out of the blue, simply invents the notion of unlawful combatant with no international precedent to basically thrust all of the detainees, Taliban and Al-Qaeda, into what is in effect a legal black hole and says, you have no rights. They concoct a mechanism to cast their legal black hole into a physical place of detention, which they do off the territory of the United States in the mistaken belief that the United States' obligations under various human rights treaties, such as the Torture Convention and the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, simply don't apply because they are outside the sovereign territory of the United States. Another example of the hopelessly bad legal advice that was given by lawyers in the Bush administration. And then, of course, there was the question with these people in detention of how to interrogate them, and the little matter of the Convention on Torture prohibiting certain forms of coercive interrogation. And many of you will be very aware of the legal advice that was provided by various people, Jay Bybee, now a federal judge, Alberto Gonzalez, now the Attorney General of the United States, John Yoo, an academic at Berkeley Law School, essentially saying this convention does not impose applicable standards in relation to our treatment of these detainees. And as I describe in the book, there is a straight line from that legal advice to the pictures that emerged at Abu Ghraib. In my view, the conditions that were generated by the lawless world that these legal advisers and the Bush administration created led directly to the abuses. Each case, of course, turns on its own facts, but it's pretty clear to me that those who gave this legal advice almost certainly crossed the line of professional irresponsibility in terms of rules of professional ethics, but may also, depending on the facts, have been crossing a line of individual criminal responsibility. The torture convention is absolutely clear in terms of prohibiting the aiding and abetting and assisting of the conduct of torture. And I think if the evidence emerges that individuals were tortured pursuant to the conditions that were created by the regulations adopted under the auspices of this legal advice, then it doesn't take an Einstein to work out. There is a perfectly good basis for investigating, for criminal responsibility, those individuals who gave that legal advice. Now, all of this, of course, came against the background of a decision that had already been taken, I think very shortly after 9/11, but was plainly beginning to be implemented in the spring of 2002, to invade Iraq and to use force to remove Saddam Hussein. And in that context, the Bush administration needed allies. And the nearest and dearest ally that it could find was the United Kingdom, which found itself under the prime ministership of Tony Blair in a situation of potential difficulty. Why? Because as early as March 2002, the Foreign Office legal advisers, all of them unanimously, had provided advice that the removal of Saddam Hussein pursuant to an objective of regime change was unlawful. They had also given legal advice that there was no basis in existing Security Council resolutions to invade Saddam Hussein. A little bit of background history here. In 1991, or 1990 and 1991, as you know, the first Gulf War took place, and it did so off the back of a series of Security Council resolutions which authorized the use of force against Saddam Hussein to remove him from Kuwait. In 1993 and in 1998, there were minor uses of force pursuant to a so-called theory of revival, the idea being that the use of force under Resolution 678 of 1990, which authorized the use of force, and Resolution 687, which imposed a Security Council ceasefire on the use of force after Iraq had been ejected from Kuwait, could revive if Saddam Hussein was in material breach of the conditions of the Security Council ceasefire. It's known as the revival theory. In March 2002, the Foreign Office legal advisor said the revival theory could not be used to remove Saddam Hussein from office because it was only intended to get him out of Kuwait. And the advice of the Foreign Office, which it was revealed for the first time in the book, in the UK edition of the book, makes clear that the only country in the world that supports the revival theory advice is the United States, and the United Kingdom has not accepted it in relation to those issues. In April 2002, President Bush meets Tony Blair at Camp Crawford, and it's pretty clear from the material that's now in the public domain, fully leaked but touched on in the book when it was first published, that Bush and Blair, by April 2002, had agreed jointly on a project to remove Saddam Hussein from office. The difficulty for Tony Blair was he didn't have the domestic political support that Bush had, and he needed to do so in accordance with international law. And the chosen legal strategy was to do so not on the basis that Saddam Hussein's Iraq threatened the United Kingdom, but on the basis that the Security Council would or had authorized the use of force against the United Kingdom. So over the period, over the summer of 2002, efforts were made to put in place, if you like, new Security Council authorization that would allow the United Kingdom and the United States to use force against Iraq. In November 2002, Resolution 1441 was adopted, and Resolution 1441 fell short of authorizing the use of force. It basically gave Saddam one last chance. Throughout this period also, the Foreign Office legal advisers in the British government took the view that 1441 was not sufficient to justify the use of force, that there was a need for a further Security Council resolution. And the British government's Attorney General shared that view. Against that background, it became clear that the British Prime Minister had a problem. in terms of obtaining authorization from the Security Council for the use of force. In February 2003, his Attorney General, as I described in the book, visits the United States, where he meets with some of the same lawyers who were involved in preparing and assisting in the preparation of the torture advice. Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Haynes at the Department of Defense, Mr. Bellinger at the National Security Council legal advice, although it's not clear that Mr. Bellinger had any involvement in any of the torture memos. He was involved in the preparation of the legal arguments for going to war. And they partly managed to persuade the British Attorney General, who finally produced his much-awaited legal advice in March 2003, on the 7th of March 2003. But the advice was equivocal. The advice basically said, I'm persuaded by the United States that there is an argument that we can use force on the basis of the revival theory of the old Security Council resolutions, but probably the better view is, if we do that and the case ever gets to a court of law, we will lose. The advice goes to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister passes it on to the military. The military take one look at it and say, no way, that is not a basis for going to war. By this point, the Bush administration is ready to go. The British Prime Minister wants to be able to join in, but he doesn't have the legal green light. What happened next is not altogether clear. What is known is that the Attorney General had a meeting on the 13th of March 2003, at which his view became clearer. And on the 17th of March 2003, 4 days later and 3 days before the war, he published an answer to a parliamentary question in the House of Lords, in which he expressed the clear and unequivocal view that force was lawful against Iraq without need for a further Security Council resolution. And the circumstances in which the advice changed into the view is not yet clear, but it is plain that there was a change, and it was a sufficient change for Britain to commit troops to war in Iraq. So that tale effectively indicates the extent to which the United Kingdom government's provision of internal legal advice has been degraded by the culture which has existed in the United States under the Bush administration, and which has allowed some of the excesses of the past 3 years to occur. The upshot of all of this is that the United States, and to a lesser extent Britain, find themselves now, I think, in an absolutely deplorable situation. Iraq is a quagmire, and it's very difficult to know how to get out of it. In getting ourselves into that quagmire, we have serially broken a whole stream of rules of international law, and we have fundamentally undermined our moral authority in the world today. I have no idea how you as law students imagine the United States is perceived today outside this country, but it's been very interesting for me spending time on this book speaking tour in the United States to get a very clear sense that there is now a real disconnect between the United States and other parts of the world in terms of how this country is perceived. The damage that has been done by Guantanamo, the damage that has been done by Abu Ghraib, the damage that has been done by prosecuting an illegal war where there were no weapons of mass destruction, and I am sure it will be shown, not even any reasonable basis for the belief that there were weapons of mass destruction. And that is what today's indictments are about in the Fitzpatrick case, and the reason why Joseph Wilson presented such a threat to the Bush administration, namely his undermining of the basis for the claim that there was a reasonable belief that Saddam Hussein held weapons of mass destruction. That is why I think these issues resonate increasingly today, and I'm hopeful perhaps that finally within the United States there will be a proper debate on all of these issues. But in the meantime, the United States has been terribly tainted and terribly damaged by the activities of a small coterie of individuals who have embarked on an effort, if you like, to systematically undermine the international rules-based system that the United States has done so much to put in place. Now, the book is a plea for the United States to re-engage. And it's a plea for the United States to re-engage because I'm passionately persuaded that if the United States is not there batting for global rules, no one else is going to be able to carry the torch. We need the United States working for the system of global rules that it put in place, because without the United States, the entire system is likely to degrade. What are the prospects of that happening? Well, to end on a slightly more optimistic note, the present situation seems to suggest that under the second Bush administration, there is now some growing recognition that terrible mistakes were made during the first term. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the little reported changes that has taken place is the modest but nevertheless significant shift of position in relation to the International Criminal Court and the decision of the Bush administration not to veto the reference to Darfur of the reference to Darfur to the prosecutor for the International Criminal Court. A second example is the acceptance by the Bush administration of the judgment of the International Court of Justice of the Avena case in relation to the treatment of detainees on death row of Mexican nationals. And that, I think, indicates a marked change of position. Some of the memos, but by no means all of them, have been discarded and replaced with memoranda that meet international standards. And of course, right now there is a debate going on, including in the op-ed pages and editorial pages of various newspapers, concerning Senator McCain's proposed new law, which would effectively incorporate international standards across the board in the United States. And there was a remarkable op-ed piece in today's Washington Post concerning the Bush administration's desire to create a carve-out for the Central Intelligence Agency, which I have to say I read as a carve-out with absolute disbelief. Quite how the President of the United States thinks he can get away in global public opinion with a proposal that would effectively allow him to determine that the CIA is entitled to torture people just strikes me as astonishing beyond belief. But it indicates, I think, quite how far this country has come in terms of a road, as someone put it, to real horror. Is the United States on the edge of turning itself into the type of country which it has, if you like, agitated against more than any other? And in the book, I reflect on a passing comment by George Kennan, the diplomat, who wrote in his famous telegram, X, signed X, in 1947, that the thing we must guard against the most is not to become like those who seek to destroy us. And I think those words resonate particularly powerful with what is left of the Bush administration in its effort to scare the American public into effectively treating foreigners in ways that are disgraceful and in ways that are un-American and in ways that are completely inconsistent with international rules. I've ended sort of on an optimistic note, but I'm not sure I can leave you completely optimistically. The last chapter of this book, which does not appear in the English edition, is an assessment, if you like, of what's going on in the second Bush term. And in preparing the chapter, at page 255, I set out a little passage that I found from a document that was not widely reported, and understandably, I think so. The National Defense Strategy, published by Donald Rumsfeld in March 2005. It's really an absolutely appalling document that begins with the words, America is a nation at war, which is palpable nonsense, but which, of course, informs the entire effort of the administration as a way of geeing up public opinion, because, of course, when you're at war, it is unpatriotic and un-American to have a go at the administration, and that's the entire rationale of this administration's effort. Then you get to a little section in this little booklet which is called America's Vulnerabilities. Okay? And amongst America's vulnerabilities is this passage. Our strength as a nation will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak, using international fora, judicial processes, and terrorism. Now, just pause there for a moment. because there you have what the drafter of this document, Mr. Donald Rumsfeld, basically believes. Joined at the hip, Al-Qaeda and international lawyers. No distinction at all, part of a plot against America. And the fact that that is as recent as March 2005, I think gives you an indication of why we cannot be complacent. These people have an agenda, and the agenda is incredibly far-reaching and incredibly damaging both for the United States and for the rest of the world. So that is what the book is about, and I'd be delighted now to answer questions and engage in discussion on any of these issues or any other things that I haven't touched on that are in the book.